In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Hello?
Hey, Em.
Hey, Anna.
From the New York Times, I'm Anna Martin. This is Modern Love, and that's my sister, Emily. Do you remember Miss Dina?
Of course I remember Miss Dina. She was our babysitter when we were living in D.C.
Miss Dina took care of me and Emily when we were young, and she's this totally mythical figure to us. Our memories of her are full of color. I remember her hair is like fire engine red.
Me too. That's okay. The only color I remember.
I remember her laugh.
I feel like she was constantly smiling.
In my memory also, she's wearing a turquoise tank top. Does that track for you?
No. In my memory, she's wearing a red tank top, V-neck, with low-rise pants.
We spent a lot of time with Miss Dina. So many snacks and neighborhood walks and books read out loud. When I asked Emily what she remembered the three of us doing together, it was those everyday things that still lingered.
I remember going to the Bed Bath & Beyond and descending down the massive escalator and just kind of looking around at our crew, which was me, you, and Miss Dina. Mm-hmm. And we're in Bed Bath & Beyond, you know, touching towels, trying out the beds.
Do you remember anything about her as, like, a human outside of taking care of us?
Honestly, I don't.
Right.
But I think that's also because we were young and our, you know, sense of her was totally determined by the amount of time she spent with us. What stands out to me about Miss Dina is that we do have these memories of her, whether we can explain the specific time and date or what we were doing, you know, is hazy. But the lasting feeling when we talk about Miss Dina is always joyful. It's warm memories. Like, that'll last for forever.
Mm-hmm.
It's so tainted gold, even though I can't. You know, I can't tell you more than five stories.
Emily's right. The specifics, they've blurred over time, but that's how growing up works. We're left with impressions and colors and feelings, and those feelings last. On her last day with us, Miss Dina gave Emily and me these picture frames, her photo and ours. On the back, she wrote, "I'll love you forever." And talking to my sister, I realized it goes both ways. We love Miss Dina forever, too.
Love now and
did you fall in love last time?
I love her.
Love was stronger than anything.
For the love.
Love.
And I love you more than anything.
There's still love.
Love.
This episode is about the secret world that lives only between babysitter and babysat. Our essay today is called The Manny Diaries, written and read by Kevin Wren.
I was 24, relatively new to New York City, working a day job I hated, waiting tables at night, and writing plays in my bedroom during any spare moment. But money was getting tight. With few options left, I decided to fall back on one job I knew would be a sure thing. Babysitting. Most of my jobs when I was growing up in New Albany, Indiana, involved working with children, including 7 years as a kinder camp counselor at my local Y and a summer theater teacher. Everyone told me that nannying was one of the best jobs for a starving artist. Playing make-believe, diving deep into a child's imagination, the laughter, the joy, until the child is hungry, angry, and having a meltdown. The question, though, wasn't whether I would be a good nanny, but if anyone would let me be a nanny, as a black man who's over 6 feet tall. Lucas's parents did. Walking into their apartment that first day, I was greeted with an unexpected hug from a small, white 4-year-old boy with a wide smile. His parents, John and Mark, were in their early 50s, slendered and tattooed, one with a sleeve. They were cool, hip, and showed me that it was possible that I too could have it all one day. The idea of having children was something I had always imagined, even more than having a partner. When it came to sex and relationships, I was a late bloomer. While college friends were busy boozing it up at house parties, I was in rehearsal for a Terrell Ava McCraney play and having my first kiss with, yes, a woman. Mainly because the script said I had to. I bloomed late all the way through college Indiana and during my early years in New York. With Lucas, I almost felt as if we were growing up together. For 2 years, until the pandemic interrupted our routine, I took him through the same daily paces. Pick him up from school, help him do his homework, feed him a snack, take him to the park, then Taekwondo, dinner, bath, bed. Things didn't always go smoothly. One day, as we were leaving the playground, Lucas had one of his witching hour meltdowns, crying and pushing me away. A particular middle-aged white woman tried to intervene. I calmly explained to her that I was his babysitter, but she wasn't backing down, figuring I was kidnapping him or something. Finally, she said, "Should I call the police?" I lost my calm and said, "Do it. I dare you." Everybody froze, and I whisked Lucas away, fighting back tears of my own. Another year passed. Lucas was now 5 as we encountered a second white woman who felt entitled to play hero, all because I was holding hands with Lucas, finding directions to the museum on my phone. She approached him saying, "Are you okay, sweetie?" Then turned to me with a look of concern. She added, "What's going on here? Do I need to call someone?" Lucas, having remembered the stressful encounter from a year earlier, looked at her and said, "Do it. I dare you." Growing up before my eyes. Soon enough, he had gone from 5 to 6, from Sesame Street to Star Wars, from symbols to statements, from chit-chats to conversations. Most days, I did the best I could to be a supportive friend to him, while trying to remain a strict adult. He already received enough of that at home, a hot and cold environment of Mark's exhausted laxity and John's anxious expectations of well-behaved perfection. To them, I was no longer just a nanny. I was family. Christmas gifts, invitations to Sunday dinners, birthdays, baptisms, and more. This was a problem, though. I was waiting for an opportunity to get out. But the closer I got to Lucas, the harder it would be for me to leave. Lucas knew I was leaving New York for the summer, traveling to go work on my plays, entering into the biggest summer of my career thus far, back-to-back residencies, and even a national new play festival. But he didn't know I wasn't coming back. Sitting on a bench in J. Hood Wright Park, I did my best to tell him the truth. I bought him ice cream to cushion the blow, fearing that hearing me say, "I'm not going to be your nanny anymore," would break his heart. As I said it, though, he was calling out to nearby pigeons, "Aw, little Pidgey, come here, little Pidgey." He was barely listening, or so I thought. I promised him that I would always be around, that I would always be his friend. And then, for the first time, I told him I loved him. He became distracted by two boys riding a child's motorcycle. "Oh, you've got to get me that for my birthday," he said. "I won't be here for your birthday," I said. "I think I already knew that."
"You did?"
"Yeah," he said.
"I've got a good memory, dude."
I laughed. But soon I was sitting still with heartbreak. I realized that he was only trying to tell me what he ultimately wished for. The motorcycle and me. The months turned to days, and days turned to hours, as I counted down my last moments with Lucas. Memories flashed through my mind. Peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for lunch, spaghetti and meatballs for dinner, accompanied by the sounds of Sammy Davis Jr., Dinah Washington, Louis Prima, and his favorite, Dean Martin. The time he saw Black Lives Matter sign hanging outside of a church and said to me, "Your life matters." Teaching him the universal sign for choking, which would later save his life when he got a snack caught in his throat, made the sign, and I gave him the Heimlich maneuver. There were so many things I still wanted to teach him, but his youth stood in the way. On my last day, I said my final goodbyes to John and Mark and asked Lucas my routine parting question. "What are you going to do while I'm gone?" "Listen to my parents," he said. We had taught each other so much, grown up together, laughed, and learned to stand our ground against strangers and their assumptions. He gave me a tight hug, and then I was off. That evening, as I was walking through Washington Heights on my way home, I began to cry, already missing his wide smile staring back at me and his tiny hand holding mine. "Remember me, Lucas. I promise to remember you. And be sure to keep your heart open as it is right now. Do it. I dare you."
After the break, a rainy day playdate at Lucas's apartment.
Here we are, 2-0.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
It's only been about a year since Kevin stopped babysitting Lucas officially. So their connection is still strong. The colors are still vivid. But they're in this interesting place where their relationship requires effort to upkeep. Kevin comes by when he can, takes Lucas to the park or to a show. Before, Kevin was just always around. Now his visits with Lucas are more rare, more special.
All right.
So a few weekends ago, Kevin and I got buzzed into this big Manhattan apartment building. And as we approached a unit on the second floor, it was totally obvious which one was Lucas's apartment.
So, this is my room. I have like...
Kids describe themselves through their stuff. So, when Lucas was giving us an exhaustive tour of his bedroom, he was introducing himself to us.
And as you can see in here, I have some like Star Wars ships in here.
Whoa!
And, like a Baby Yoda headband.
Oh my gosh, the Yoda headband.
That I got for Disney World at my 7th birthday. I went on like Tower of Terror and I was so scared. I'm like, and all you could see was my ears. All you could see was my ears.
Wait, I've been on Tower of Terror too and it is terrifying because you go up and then you,
and
never
then you like drop down.
I know.
Should we go sit on the couch so it's more comfortable and hang out?
As soon as Kevin sat down, Lucas immediately climbed into his lap. Kevin wrapped his arms around Lucas, and for the first time since we arrived, Lucas relaxed. The thing that struck me was how natural the two of them looked. Their affection was still instinctual, immediate.
What was your popular dinner that I would make you all the time?
Spaghetti.
Spaghetti meatballs. And what would we listen to when we ate?
Dinner jazz.
Sitting there across from Kevin and Lucas, I thought about the many, many nights I spent curled with Miss Dina on my own couch, her reading out loud to me. Sometimes I'd fall asleep and I'd wake up and I'd still be in her lap. I remember feeling so safe. When Miss Dina left, I felt that way a lot less often. That unadulterated trust, that calm, knowing there's someone older and wiser to hold on to. There's beauty in leaning on someone in that way. Yeah. And then Lucas wanted a snack.
This is my kitchen.
In the kitchen, I wandered over to the fridge, which was covered in these Polaroid snapshots of the two of them.
Wait, and then what's this one? And then you're here eating?
Oranges. Because we like just like squirt each other in the eye.
We're just like, with a little citrus.
In each photo, Kevin looks pretty much the same. He's got a different shirt, or his hair is slightly different, but he's smiling the same giant, infectious smile. But Lucas, in each photo, he's a different version of himself. In the earliest one, he's almost impossibly tiny, and his wispy little hair is pulled up into a bun. In another, his smile is a constellation of baby teeth and the spaces left when they fall out. And in the most recent one, his hair is long and floppy, and there's some grown-up teeth coming in. Lucas is growing. He's changing at the alarming rate kids do. The memories associated with these photos, they'll fade. And soon, it will just be the photos. In 20 years, I imagine Lucas looking at this Polaroid, the way I look at my picture of Miss Dina. Maybe he won't remember any of the details. But maybe, like me, he'll see beyond the picture. And he'll know there's someone out there who loves him, even though all the rest has faded. On the next Modern Love, a mother and a son go for a walk on the beach. And the mother lets her son in on a secret. That's next week. Modern Love is produced by Julia Botero and Hans Buteau. It's edited by Sarah Saracen. This episode was mixed by Dan Powell, who also created our wonderful Modern Love theme music and all the original music throughout this episode. Digital production by Mahima Chablani. And a special thanks to John and Mark, Lucas's dads, who graciously welcomed us into their home. The Modern Love column is edited by Daniel Jones. Mia Lee is the editor of Modern Love Projects. I'm Anna Martin. Thanks for listening.